This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political GabFest, can the minimum wage rescue the Democrats' electoral chances in 2014? Also, when and how can American Jews criticize Israel? I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, Britney Spears, yes, is going to Vegas. What to make of this fact? And then, Call the Midwife is a delightful nostalgic trip back to the original age of austerity. And then, Martin Scorsese returns with a vivid and amoral romp called The Wolf of Wall Street.
I tell you what, you show me a pay stub for $72,000 on it, I quit my job right now and I work for you. Hey, Paulie, what's up? No, yeah, no, everything's fine. Hey, listen, I quit.
We'll start with the Political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. A new progressive mayor in New York and battles to raise the minimum wage popping up all over the country. Are we on the verge of a new progressive era? And then Hillel, the Jewish community center on college campuses, is being fractured by a battle over whether it should allow conversations that are very critical of Israel. How should American Jews talk about Israel? Joining me in Washington is Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon. Hello, Emily.
Hey, David.
And sitting in for John Dickerson is Slate senior editor Will Salatan. Hi, Will.
Shalom.
New York inaugurated Mayor Bill de Blasio on Wednesday, and he swept into office promising a progressive agenda for the city of New York, particularly going to attack the inequality in that city. At the same time, Democrats who are anxious, I think is a weak word for how they feel about the 2014 election, are pushing the idea that minimum wage measures on the ballot can help them stave off losses to the Republicans in 2014 can help them reverse the story of the last few months, which is the story about the failures of Obamacare. They think that perhaps these minimum wage fights will attract Republicans, will galvanize Democratic voters who might not want to turn out for a mid-year election, and will distract people from the problems with the health care reform. So, Will, why is this issue of minimum wage coming up now so strong?
Well, I mean, they're going into an election year. I mean, I'm kind of sad about this. Politics used to be about trying to win over people who were in the middle or draw some people over who had voted for the other party in the last election. And now it's just about everybody's polarized and it's all about turning out your base.
But I don't think that's true.
I think you still go for people in the middle. I think
the minimum wage is, right.
Yes, the Democrats like this issue because it's polling at like 2/3 support, which suggests it's not their liberal base alone at all, that there are lots of moderates who actually see this as a good way to make sure that people who work are above the poverty line.
Well, that's not actually moderates. I don't think it's moderates, actually, Emily. I think what you have is a lot of you have a Democratic Party, which is essentially united in the idea that minimum wage has to go up. And then you have a Republican Party, which is terribly split along economic lines. And it's poor Republicans think the minimum wage should go up. They are not moderate.
Well, surely there are some centrists who are in this camp, too. But yeah, OK. So your point is it has even broader appeal that actually there are reliable Republican voters who also see the raising the minimum wage as appealing.
Right.
Yeah. Now, you're not going to believe this, but I actually was, before you had jumped in, I really was going to say that I think this is a good idea. So while I don't like the politics of just trying to draw out the base,
we do not think that is the politics.
Okay,
go ahead.
Right. While I don't like that trend, I do like this particular issue. Okay. And the reason I like this particular issue is, first of all, it is the job of the Progressive Party, the party on the left of the country, to draw boundaries to the free market. Okay. And we are now in an economy that is beginning to expand again. And so when there is success, a basic principle, and this I would say is a principle of society, a moral principle under capitalism, is everybody should have a piece of the success and everybody should feel like they're being brought along. The Republican Party in this country has become an extremely libertarian party. They cannot be counted on to support this. And this is something the Democratic Party should do because it is right. And ordinary people who believe in the free market, they don't mean that everybody should just sink if they have trouble. They believe in the work ethic. That is the ordinary person's understanding of this. If you work, you should be able to make a living wage.
Right. And the shocking statistic that is driving the push for the minimum wage is that you can work a 40-hour week and, if you are part of a family, still be below the poverty line. Right. That's just a really upsetting, kind of unconscionable idea. And I think there's an intuitive appeal to lots of different people that you want to fix that. And then, to help it along more, the people who oppose raising the minimum wage have not made a really convincing argument against it. There's this idea that it will reduce the number of jobs or hurt employers of low wage workers. And I suppose the second part has to be true because, you know, there is a cost to raising the minimum wage. But I don't think the research shows that you actually drive up unemployment by paying people this small amount more. And the reason is that if you look at the minimum wage and the relative cost, you know, compared to the late 60s, we are way, way under where we were then, like more than $3.
Right. There's not a single state in the country that has a minimum wage that matches what the minimum wage was in the 1960s. So that if you account for inflation. So the state with the highest minimum wage is Washington State, where the minimum wage, I think, is $9.32. The federal minimum wage is $7.25. $9.32 is still a full dollar below where the minimum wage would be had it kept pace with inflation, which is pretty shocking. There's not a single place. D.C. may be about to become that place because there's a push to raise the minimum wage here in D.C. to $11.50.
Right. Go ahead.
I was going to say that the minimum wage doesn't mean what it used to. So I don't know about everybody here, but I had, you know, I had several minimum wage jobs when I was a kid or a college student.
When it was okay.
Right. And that's – everybody sort of understands that that's the kind of job where you want to have as many people employed as possible. But what has happened is so many people now – who make minimum wage are people who are supporting the household.
Right.
And so that's why, back to your point, Emily, that's why I think a lot of those Republican-leaning voters, even reliably Republican voters, are supporting this because they know that we're talking about the head of the household and just being able to make enough of a living to support your family.
Right. And that because we have lost all these manufacturing jobs and people are instead employed in these low-wage service jobs, this is the reality of this wage pool, right? And it's not going to go driving itself up just because of the other elements in this cost scenario.
I want to make two points. One is that a lot of the critics of the minimum wage say, oh, there aren't that many people who are affected by the minimum wage. Not that many people relatively are paid the minimum wage, which is true. But the minimum wage has an anchoring effect, as a piece in Slate by Barry Schwartz pointed out, which is that people who want to show themselves to be good employers will pay $1, $2 above minimum wage to prove that they're good employers. And so if you raise minimum wage to $10, what you're going to do is you're going to raise the pool for the people at the very bottom, but you're also going to raise wages for the people who are just above that. The other point I wanted to make is the thing that I think is very clever about this as a strategy for Democrats is that the federal minimum wage is hopeless. They are not going to get a $10 federal minimum wage passed through this Congress. It's a DOA issue. But this is an issue that can be taken. You can accomplish things at the state, so it can be a national rhetorical issue for the Democrats. And it can actually have accomplishments at a state level, which is unusual.
All right. So I agree with the political analysis there. But on a policy level, I am concerned that if this is done, especially for political reasons, because there are local congressional races where the Democrats want to play this issue. So you do these state ballot initiatives, right, in local things. If you start raising the minimum wage piecemeal in some states, in some cities, don't you have the race to the bottom problem where Rick Perry will come into your state and say, you can have cheaper labor if you are in Texas, or, you know, that the right to work states, the states with the lower minimum wages and labor laws will start drawing away.
I mean, the real answer is we don't know because we haven't had that kind of national attention to this issue that would create that laboratory. But there is one piece of research, I think it's by David Card, in which there was a raise to the minimum wage, I think, in part of New Jersey, but not all of it, or it was New Jersey compared to Pennsylvania. They had two neighboring communities, one with a dollar or two higher and one lower. And there was that effect did not take place. You did not see a race to the bottom.
And if you look, the West Coast has a much higher minimum wage than anywhere else. So Washington, Oregon, and California are all $9 and above. I don't think you could say that the economies of those states are suffering in comparison to Idaho, Montana,
Wyoming,
Utah.
No, in fact, just to reel off the other states,
the states that have the lowest minimum wage, the states that have no minimum wage, or there are some states which actually have minimum wages which are set below the federal minimum wage. Now, they can't enforce that because the federal minimum wage overrides it. But if you look at those states, they're very poor southern states.
Right. Now, how far would you extend that argument? What is the breaking point? So I think we could probably agree that going up to $10, which is what's being talked about, nationally and in some places would not have that the effect. Is it in SeaTac where they're talking about $15? Mm-hmm. There are places where they're talking about an amount of money where that equation might turn.
Yeah, at some point it would change. And I don't think we know what the, you know, breaking point that would be. We're so far away from that that there is actually lots of political hay and actual benefit to be had before we get to that, right?
Right. Yeah, although I hope the benefit is for the people making the money. The politics of this don't, you know, I'd rather set aside. But a lot of real people will be able to support their families.
Yeah, I mean, that could make a huge difference. I mean, the other intuitive appeal of this is that to some degree, the anti-poverty programs or initiatives we've been seeing out of Washington have less to do with work, right? In the transition from welfare, there's a lot of attention to the earned income tax credit, which is a super efficient way to get poor people more money, and which is also tied to work. But it doesn't have the same kind of very basic intuitive appeal of like, okay, my paycheck is bigger every week. I am making more money as opposed to the government is giving me a bigger break at the end of the year.
Let's turn to the larger progressive project. So I was driving home yesterday from New York to D.C., and the de Blasio inauguration ceremony was on. And so we ended up listening to much of it. It was the inauguration of de Blasio as mayor and then also the controller and the public advocate of New York. And so there were a bunch of speeches and poems and invocations and things like that. And it was stunning, stunning how left-wing it was. It was really like listening to something out of 1972, not something out of 2014. It was
incredible.
Well, that's
interesting because when I read about de Blasio's actual ideas, you see this like awesome idea for a full-day pre-K for four-year-olds paid for by what looks like a teeny-weeny little increase on the tax on the rich. So does that liberal rhetoric actually translate into policy?
I don't know, but it was really, as somebody who's a huge admirer of Mayor Bloomberg and what he did for that city, I found it weird that the emphasis has turned so much to...
You must have been miserable.
I was irritated by a lot of it. It turns so much to the focus on inequality, first of all, as a mayoral task. Not that inequality is a curse, it's a cancer on the country. But it seems to me the job of a mayor is kind of building infrastructure, ensuring public safety, making sure their public parks are open, trying to fix the schools, all of which it seems to me Mike Bloomberg did. The inequality question is much bigger. But I wasn't getting into this in order to have a discussion about Mike Bloomberg. It was more like this progressive rhetoric appears to actually have life in a way that it hasn't in this country for a long time.
Well, or at least it does in New York City.
Well, New York City or Seattle elected this socialist member of Congress. I mean, you still have Move On. You still have the Occupy Wall Street movement. Never turned into anything, but it was a huge movement.
But I think it's important that in these cities that you're identifying, you're talking about prosperous cities that still have a kind of sense of real urban poverty that is alongside people who are making more and more money. And then the question for de Blasio will be, you know, how do you get a little bit more tapped from the rich to help with particularly the issues of education and you know, redistribution for poor people without alienating Wall Street so much that you cause some big backlash and get yourself into big trouble with the business
community. This is the question for you, Will, is the Democratic Party, so the Republican Party has had this fissure in the last few years caused by the Tea Party, where you have a Tea Party which is populist. I mean, it's anti-corporate. That anti-corporatism hasn't played out into any actual policy changes on the Republican side that I've seen. The Tea Party movement was kind of anti-corporate, anti-big special interest, and it's caused psoriasis for a lot of mainstream Republicans. Are the Democrats about to be afflicted with the same dermatological illness? I mean, are they about to have this grabbing at them?
Possibly, but look, I don't think it's a bad thing. It's a good thing that there is a rekindling of the progressive movement in this country. It's a good thing because we need to balance out the crazy right-wing Tea Party, okay? Politically, the left can sort of restore some balance and can give politicians some support to do some intelligent things. But those things need to be practical. So the great thing is that there's a progressive movement, but what has to be done now is for the political leaders and policymakers to manage this.
Coming up, a new controversy over how much criticism of Israel American Jewish groups should permit. You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and Will Salatin, and this is the political Gabfest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. Hillel is an international Jewish campus organization that tries to promote Jewish identity among college students. It sponsors speakers, events, often has like the only kosher dining hall on a lot of campuses. It's the de facto Jewish community center on a lot of college campuses. This month, a controversy about the breadth of discussion this organization should allow broke out on the campus of Will's alma mater.
Oh, right.
Swarthmore
I didn't
College.
Even make that connection. But you really have a personal
stake here.
We've got
Harvard
here. We have three
Harvard,
Jews,
Yale, and Swarthmore.
And we're even representing the relevant college institution.
So basically what happened at Swarthmore is that the Swarthmore Hillel organization said that it was going to allow speakers and partner with organizations that had more gloomy views about Israel,
that were
skeptical view.
Explicitly used
they
the term
They did explicitly use the term anti-Zionist views of Israel than Hillel allows. Hillel has a national policy which says, well, we'll get to that in 1 second, but basically you cannot, if you're a Hillel organization, you can't work with speakers, have speakers, or work with organizations that are anti-Zionist, apply a double standard to Israel, delegitimize Israel, call for boycotts, what else?
Or foster an atmosphere of incivility, that awful, vague catch-all that gets everybody into trouble.
So, Will, should this organization have these standards that limit the kind of discussion that happened about Israel? And has Swarthmore breached those standards?
Yeah, Swarthmore might have breached the standards, but the standards are stupid, okay? Hillel is wrong. I'm not going to say Hillel is morally wrong. Hillel is correct to say, you know, sort of as a free speech matter, look, you can always get some other organization to sponsor your Palestinian speaker on campus or whatever. They're correct to say it's not censorship, but it's stupid. It's stupid because, and they say, well, we don't want the Hillel brand, you know, to be associated with sort of anti-Israel, what they think are anti-Israeli policies. Well, David, let's go back to what you said. Hillel is the Jewish community center. The Jewish community is diverse. That's what we are. The ancient rule of Judaism, two Jews, three opinions, okay? We don't agree on things. The notion that you're going to, you know, tell a Jewish group on campus, no, you can't have this speaker, that's against our policy, it's like, it just goes against what Judaism is about. And it brands Hillel as the people who don't want to have open debate, okay? They won't allow Hillel sponsorship to be used for a speaker or an event that is co-sponsored.
And at Harvard, this meant that Avraham Burg,
right,
an esteemed former Israeli,
right,
government official, couldn't speak at Hillel.
So,
had to cross the street and go talk somewhere else because the Palestinian Solidarity Committee was co-sponsoring.
Right. And he could have been talking about chocolate cake. Okay, he could have talked about anything. But the fact that the Palestinian group on campus, which had a position that Hillel didn't agree with, was co-sponsoring. You can't do this. Anyone who's ever been to one of these colleges knows. You run an organization, you go to the other organizations on campus, you seek, will you help us sponsor this? Can we pool our resources?
So what's really going on here, though? I mean, I think it's important to get out there that this is about trying to keep some views about Israel beyond the pale, right? It's trying to equate advocating for a boycott of Israeli academics, which we've just seen the American Studies Association do in this country, and this is a real threat. It's trying to keep things like boycott, divestment, sanctions, and eventually annihilating the state of Israel off the table as polite discourse in the
same category
as racism.
Those are four things. One is totally different.
Well,
boycott, divestment, and sanctions are one thing.
Annihilation of the state is another.
A completely different conversation. But I think to play this out,
the people who...
And the reason I'm interrupting, okay, that kind of conflation is what makes this so impossible.
Well,
like, the idea that Peter Beinart, who has called for a boycott, is not allowed to speak...
In the West Bank.
Allowed to speak at Hillel events because he said there should be a boycott of things made in the territories is insane.
Well, okay.
That's insane.
You know,
to say that that position is anathema to reasonable debate about Judaism and about Israel seems to me crazy.
So why is it crazy? I mean, I would argue that the reason it's crazy, maybe, is that Israel is different from places like China and Burma, right? So the classic pro... Well, I don't want to say pro-Israel because I don't want to buy into that term. But the traditional knee-jerk, we can't discuss this argument, is that it's holding Israel to a double standard. There are lots of repressive regimes. Why do we think Israel has any more responsibility to be fair and just than anywhere else? I mean, I personally, as a huge supporter of Israel, want to reject the premise. I don't want Israel to be like on the same table as China and Burma anyway in terms of this. But I do think Israel is different in that it is completely and fully a democracy. The people run Israel. They choose the leaders in Israel. This is not a small group of repressive regime leaders making bad choices that are not really in the name of the people. And so you can argue that boycotts and sanctions and divestment are an appropriate tool in this context because what you need to do is pressure the public in Israel to change its leadership and get rid of people like Bibi Netanyahu who are insisting on building settlement after settlement. settlement, making it really hard to disentangle and arguably weakening Israel's future in the process, as opposed to the traditional view that this is the strengthening move. I do think, though, that if you oppose boycotting Israel, which and aspects of Israel, which I absolutely do, that there is a fear that once you allow this to be part of the regular conversation, you are making Israel into a South Africa-like regime in terms of the way people see it. And then especially on the sort of young, sensitive, melding minds world of college campuses, that that would make Jewish leaders really sensitive. I mean, I think it's not going to work in the end. For the reasons Will said, it's actually like really bad PR for Hillel. And also, if people are starting to talk about boycotts and sanctions, Hillel refusing to co-sponsor speakers is not going to make that talk go away. You're better off going for the marketplace of ideas. Like, here's why we disagree. We have the better argument. That's the smarter stance. But I understand the real discomfort. If you believe that boycotts and sanctions are one step away from arguing for the annihilation of Israel, then it is understandable that this makes you very nervous.
What I'd understand if you believe that, what would you say that critics of Israel were allowed to talk about? What are they allowed to say that would that would not put them beyond the pale? If you're somebody who believes that settlement policy is a moral crime and an actual crime, and that the occupation, the way it is carried out, is morally wrong, what are you allowed to say that keeps you in the community?
Well, that's the problem with this policy, the way it's been implemented. You know, according to the New York Times, there are a whole bunch of student Hillels that haven't been allowed to invite J Street to come and talk. J Street being the liberal Jewish alternative to
APAC. Hillel claims that nationally they have no policy against J Street.
Maybe, but it sounds like that was seen as sort of a fundraising problem at those local Hillels because of the importance of the partnership between APAC and Hillel. I'm a little skeptical that there's really no connection. And once you're in a world where essentially you can't say that the settlement policy of Israel is morally reprehensible and terrible for the country's future, that is where you're in crazy-making land, right? And it's because of the overbreadth of this policy that it is clearly just feels wrong.
What I feel like we could do that's constructive, we should rewrite this policy for Hillel, okay?
I was kind of doing that and thinking, what would we think if the policy just said, we will not co-sponsor or have speakers who deny Israel's right to exist?
And by right to exist, you mean period, or as a Jewish state, or
as a Jewish state,
within borders,
period,
or
whatever the language was for the
rest
of the
actually,
it was basically
a lot of,
like as a Jewish state, which essentially means.
But if you saw the New York Times today, there's a big controversy because Netanyahu is demanding the Palestinians recognize Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state as a precondition for any talks.
Right.
So that would mean no Palestinian.
You would still
speakers.
Not have any Palestinian speakers, mm-hmm. but you, at least you would let J Street in the door. I'm not sure that's actually better. What would you do, Will?
I'm looking at the policy language, and I can't find anything in here that I would keep. You can't delegitimize. Oh, come on. Demonize. Come on. Apply the double standard. Okay. We've all written articles. What is the most annoying complaint you get from readers all the time? You didn't address my issue. You wrote about your subject, but you left out this other thing. And you're like, you're reading this like, what are you talking about? I'm making a point. I don't have to make every point. And this double standard comes in all the time when you criticize Israel and they say, but you didn't criticize Burma.
Okay, so this is easy for us to agree on, and certainly fostering an atmosphere of incivility we're going to be horrified
this
by.
This looks like written by the people who write speech codes at colleges, which are terrible.
I completely agree. But what about, should Hillel be able to say, as the kind of mainstream college Jewish group, we are not going to have people sit at the table who think Israel should be annihilated, wiped off the map as a Jewish state?
Yeah, of course. I mean, first of all, if you have to have this policy and enforce it against all your local chapters in the fancy colleges, you're in serious trouble.
Well, that's why this Swarthmore move is so problematic for Hillel.
That was a really Jewish discussion. I hope we didn't lose all our listeners.
I think everyone here is happy. I don't know about
that. Wasn't two Jews, three. That was like three Jews, five opinions.
No, it was like three Jews, like two and a half opinions.
I know. I was going to say.
We needed someone on the right there speaking up for Hillel, you know, taking a bat to Peter Beinart's head.
Let Hillel come back with a more nuanced policy, and then that'll make for a tougher debate.
All right. That'll do it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture Gabfest starts right now.
This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Slate Culture Gabfest, The Wolf of Wall Street. It's the new movie from Martin Scorsese. It's generating interest and conflict. We'll discuss it on the show. And then a British TV import about midwives in the 1950s. Could it be the next Downton Abbey? And finally, Britney Spears is playing Vegas. Joining me is our film critic, Dana Stevens. Hello, Dana.
Hey, Stephen.
And June Thomas, whose title is what? Slate's culture critic?
And editor of Outward, yes.
Editor of Outward, of course. Dana, of course I'm going to start with you. The Wolf of Wall Street is the new movie from Martin Scorsese. It stars Leonardo DiCaprio as a kind of pump-and-dump artist in the early 90s. It's based on the true story of a man named Jordan Belfort who is eventually taken, it gives nothing away to say, eventually taken down by the forces that be, some combination of the FBI and the SEC. It's a very long film, Dana. I'm curious to get a thumbs up, thumbs down from you. But then after that, to move very quickly to the controversies surrounding the movie, because it's engendering a lot of dialogue about whether it itself is overly amoral and voyeuristic. But first, tell me what you thought of the movie.
I really didn't like it at all. I thought it was far too long and far too sort of tonally unvaried, and that there was just too much Leo bad behavior along with Jonah Hill bad behavior sort of in an unvaried string for 3 hours. But my objections to it do not lie along those lines that you just outlined, that it's an amoral movie or that Scorsese is somehow promoting or glorifying obscenely rich banker behavior. I don't see that in the movie at all. I think it's a critique, but it just seems like a very boring critique to me.
So, I mean, this is certainly one thing people are saying about it, June, that it's too long by, I mean, pick your quantity of time. I mean, half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour. I thought it was too long by an hour. But, June, before I ask you what you thought of the movie, and I'm dying to know, I'd like to play a clip from the film. For those of our listeners who haven't heard it, we'll give you a little taste of its va-va-voom.
Short Pfizer.
$30,000 in 1 month, Jordy? Huh?
They're business expenses. Yes.
Jordy, what? Look what you got here.
What?
Look at this. $26,000 for one dinner.
No. This could be explained. Dad, we had Pfizer clients.
In. Right. The porterhouse from Argentina.
The expensive champagne and the wine. We had to buy champagne. And you ordered all the sides. Tell them about the sides.
I
you
ordered the sides. So
sides?
Yeah.
Sides?
Okay,
$26,000 worth of sides? What are these sides? They cure cancer?
The sides did cure cancer. That's the problem. That's why they were expensive.
Okay, so in that clip, Rob Reiner plays the accountant father of Jordan Belfort, played by Leonardo DiCaprio. His father has at least some remnant of a conscience about how money is made and spent. And Jonah Hill plays the co-founder of the firm, and he's kind of cracking wise, and Rob Reiner's getting angrier and angrier. On and on and on and on. June, did you find the movie too long? And if so, by how much?
Oh, by about 2 hours. I mean, I really did not like this movie at all. And I found myself just looking at my watch in a way that, you know, we talked on this podcast about Blue is the Warmest Color, which is also a 3-hour movie. I never once looked at my watch. In this film, it would be kind of where I think it's got to be close to the end and it would only be like an hour in. I just found it way too long. And only because it was so repetitive, I just really... If I had not known that this was a Martin Scorsese movie, I don't know that I would have picked up that this was a film made by a great director, because to me it just seems so self-indulgent, as you said, Dana, just on the same tone over and over. And I must admit that also I felt like perhaps I was simply, you know, not the right audience. Because, for example, there's a scene in the film where, you know, in some ways this film is like a 3-hour infomercial for Quaaludes, and there was a scene where Jonah Hill and Leo DiCaprio take these kind of classic Quaaludes that have been, you know, on a shelf.
Dead stock, man.
And they take a long time to kick in, by which time they've taken far more of them than they should. And so Leo has this scene where he's essentially kind of, his muscles are in spasm and he's just out of it. And the people in the theater were laughing. And I mean, and it wasn't that I was, you know, appalled or ashamed or any of that. I just, like, it was so not funny to me. It just went on for so long. And yet, I just thought, well, maybe it's just me because everyone else was cracking up.
Well, that Quaalude scene in which he crawls to his car, it's kind of the big comic set piece of the movie. And as I say in my review, I mean, I would have found it funny if it hadn't been surrounded by 10 similar scenes on each side. Yeah. I kind of wish we had a partisan of the movie in here, because there are a lot of really smart critics who love this movie and are defending the very repetitiveness and, you know, that dulling effect that it has on the viewer as part of what the movie's intending to do. And when I read these kind of pains to the movie's great pulsing vitality, I think, was I watching a different movie?
Exactly. What do you think, Stephen? Are you one of those defenders?
Oh, no, not at all. I thought the movie was 2 hours and 45 minutes too long. I mean, my problem with the movie is a problem I'm having retrospectively with American Hustle, which is I'm not quite clear on the timing of it. I mean, you know, we're now close to 30 years after the movie Wall Street. Would you say that the moral universe of this film, of Scorsese's film, is any more developed, or the you know, intricacy with which the director or the writer of the film, you know, understand the, you know, amorality of Wall Street and the financialization of the economy, is it any more developed than Oliver Stone's was back in 19 whatever it was, 85, 86? Kind of not. I mean, one interesting thing I think about the movie is a lot of people are talking about, oh, this is your, they say to me, because I'm writing a book about the 1980s, they say, this is your era. This isn't a book about the 1980s. It's about the 90s. It's about the next stock bubble after the Reagan stock bubble. And that's really when Belfort in the early 90s made his, and up through the mid-90s made a ton of money. So it's really about partially what my book is about, which is how the 1980s didn't end. And to that point, what I objected to most about the movie is, to my mind, the very worst response and least sophisticated response to the financial crisis, the recent financial crisis, is that we've tried to compensate for not understanding how it was structural, endemic, and pervasive by punishing colorful villains like Bernie Madoff, right? And demonizing and villainizing, it seemed to me, are entirely beside the point. We're now 5 years beyond the Lehman blow-off. People have a very developed understanding of exactly the mechanics behind people making these totally spurious fortunes. Do we really need a vicarious movie, a movie that seems to take its energy from the cult of personality of someone at the middle of a boiler room scheme? It seems to me extremely untimely and extremely unthoughtful. I did not like this movie in the least.
Well, do you agree then, Steve? It sounds like you are leaning toward the side of saying that, that Scorsese is somehow endorsing, ratifying this kind of behavior, or at least kind of letting the audience get off on it as the way he does.
I mean, this genre has been around since forever. I mean, literally hundreds of years, telling a story, a kind of prurient story with maybe a gloss, a discernible gloss of, you know, kind of finger wagging to it. But what people are really responding to in Becky Sharp, Jordan Belfort, Gordon Gekko, on and on and on, is the kind of sexiness of the villainy of the central character. And your introduction to the world of villainy that you suspect is there and your worst and most lurid fears about are confirmed. I mean, I think the movie could split that baby in half and I wouldn't be unhappy with it. To my mind, it's the lack of depth of understanding that I feel like the movie actually transcended once and did so sincerely. I don't think it gives very much away to say there's a scene, an extraordinary scene on the yacht where the FBI agents first make contact with Belfort and they are toying with one another and Belfort thinks he can seduce them and perhaps even bribe them and they kind of half play along and the cat and mouse game that everyone watching the movie knows will eventually end in him getting caught has begun, right? I thought that was a great scene. I thought that was a terrific scene. But Belfort taunts one of the FBI agents once he realizes he's not winning the cat and mouse game. He taunts him with how little money he makes and what it's like to be on the return subway ride home to his Outerbourne, no doubt Outerbourne house. And to my mind, the one great shot of the movie that showed that a thinking film director, a thoughtful film director, was behind the whole project was that shot eventually in the movie, in the last half hour of the movie, of that FBI agent on the subway ride home. And he looks around and he sees the faces of Asian immigrants returning to wherever it is in Queens or outer Brooklyn. And it's the first time you're outside of the universe of Jordan Belfort.
I also wanted to hear what you guys thought of the portrait of women, such as it was in the movie. Did this movie strike you as misogynistic? It obviously has, you know, lots of strippers and prostitutes and, you know, women as consumables are all over the movie. There's also, I thought, a pretty great performance by Margot Robbie as Leonardo DiCaprio's wife, a very thankless role. She's essentially a ditzy blonde from Brooklyn that he marries and then, you know, immediately proceeds to cheat on. Right. So I was wondering, again, whether that struck you as a symptom that Martin Scorsese is chronicling or some a persistent symptom that he himself is participating in.
I think he was chronicling it rather than, you know, lauding it. I mean, I don't think that that Scorsese is saying, hey, look how great, what great fun it is. I mean, yeah, I think he's saying, look how awful this is.
I mean, if you think about a movie like American Hustle, which can't really be compared to this movie, but let's say that it's sort of David O. Russell's attempt to go Scorsese, right? It's sort of his Goodfellas. I mean, the role of women and the significance of women in that universe, which is also, you know, in some ways a very male-run, you know, gangster and politician-based universe, is just so much more significant and more interesting than anything that women do in this movie. I mean, that may just also be Martin Scorsese's age. He's 71. You know, I don't think he's particularly interested in exploring the experience of what it is to be the Duchess of Bay Ridge, the wife of Jordan Belfort. But Margot Robbie still comes up with something.
Amen.
Oh, my God. Hear, hear. All right. Well, let's get out of Jordan Belfort's mind and move on. But the movie is The Wolf of Wall Street, directed by Martin Scorsese. Martin Scorsese starring Leonardo DiCaprio. We're very curious to know what you thought of it because there's a lot of passion on both sides of the fence. So go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest, and tell us what you thought. Coming up, Brittany is going to Vegas. Is this a heavenly marriage or a sad second act? You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. If you'd like to find links for the things that we mention on the program, we collect them for you on our show page, wnyc.org/Gabfest. And please, while you're there, leave a comment. Let us know what you think of us. That's wnyc.org/Gabfest. Okay, moving on. Call the Midwife is a BBC import that's now entering its third season in the United States. June, tell me about this show. First of all, it's a huge, huge hit in England, and it's starting to catch on in the United States. Give us a little background on the show.
It's true. It's almost surprising to me how huge it is ratings-wise in Britain. On Christmas Day, you know, in Britain, they have these big Christmas episodes, and the big showdown this year was between Downton, which is a commercial television ITV show, and Call the Midwife on the BBC. And Call the Midwife won. Call the Midwife got more viewers. It is a very sort of classic British type of show in that it's essentially about nostalgia. It's set in the 1950s in the East End of London. It's based in reality, although it's heavily fictionalized. It's based on the memoirs of a woman called Jenny Wirth, who is a character in the show. And she was a sort of a middle-class woman who trained to be a midwife and went to work in the East End of London in the late 1940s, in the 50s. The TV show is set in the 50s. And, you know, it's about the austerity Britain. And for me, a lot of the appeal is in these, and I think it's very self-consciously so, nostalgic. I mean, I think British viewers will sort of hear different things than maybe Americans, like, so Garibaldi biscuits and Brill cream and these mentions of old brand names. And, you know, it's all about sort of that old spirit, you know, the East End spirit when things were different. And I think that it's a very sort of, you know, it's like a warm bath. It's like a glass of Horlicks or a cup of Horlicks, which, of course, is another brand name.
I want to know what Horlicks is, because in the holiday special, there was much to do about making mugs of Horlicks, and I have no idea what it is.
I love Horlicks. It's a sort of a malted milk drink, but it's old-fashioned. I mean, it still exists, but it's got that sort of, it's something that your grandparents would have drunk.
Can I tell you what surprised me about Call the Midwife? I've been hearing about it and hearing raves about it ever since it started, and I've been putting off watching it because I thought it would be too depressing. Nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, because, you know, it was always discussed in the reviews that the scenes of birth are sort of more realistic and harsh, and, you know, there might be dying babies, and I don't know, because it was post-war conditions in Britain, I somehow thought it was going to be this sort of like early Mike Lee kind of, I love early Mike Lee, but, something of a moral slog, like people treating each other horribly and sort of toothless old men yelling on street corners. It is the sweetest, most Dickensian, charming. That holiday special was total Charles Dickens, straight up.
It absolutely is. I love the Christmas special. It was very emotional. It was, you know, again,
it ends with a wedding.
Yeah, I mean, how can you not like it? But the show, the regular show, I find a little bit hard to take, and I can't actually watch it because the stakes are always a mother or a child in peril. Because it's always the same question, really. Will this baby be born healthily, safely? And I have found that as much as I love this show, I mean, in theory, I love the show. I love that it's so gynocentric. I love that it's about, you know, the birth of the NHS.
It's got Jenny Agutter as a nun. I mean,
exactly.
How can you go wrong?
Jenny Agutter, it's got, yeah, exactly. And it's got, I mean, Vanessa Redgrave does the little, you know, voiceover intro.
She does.
And outro.
I didn't recognize her voice.
Yeah. It sounded a little bit crackly, actually. But instead of pleasuring me, it actually agitates me to such an extent that I can't really enjoy it because I'm just like too stressed out about the kids and the moms.
So does it happen? It didn't happen in the Christmas special. I guess on Christmas you're not going to do this, but does it happen on the show that a baby is just born dead and just leave it there?
Yeah, I mean, things go wrong. And there, they have to have things go wrong to keep those stakes going. And so, yeah, and even if they didn't, though, because it's still about the stress and the, you know, the agitation, to me, that it's just it's a personal thing. It's just not for me. I just find it too stressful. But I think it's a wonderful, warm show.
Yeah, and this was my first toe dip into it, and I quite liked what little I saw. I very much liked it, and would like to go back and to the beginning and watch the whole thing. Of course, it's a nostalgia trip, right? I mean, it's interesting to ask nostalgic for what. June, you mentioned the Britain of the austerity years of the 50s, and what I think a lot of Americans may not realize is even though the 1950s were a period of unparalleled affluence in the United States, Europe was rebuilding, and England was quite austere. It's the era of tinned meats, Harold Macmillan, and the Suez Crisis, on and on and on. It was a somewhat bleak period. But am I right in thinking, June, that the nostalgia here is that it was a period of shared sacrifice and shared austerity? And regardless of whether it's a merited nostalgia or rooted entirely in fact, you know, the austerity is now, of course, a byword for a very specific economic plan, which is attempting to balance budgets or at least bring public debt into line, even though there's an unemployment problem and no inflation problem. And that has resulted in an austerity of profoundly unshared sacrifices, right? That the 1% has merely moved further into the reaches of the, you know, upper reaches of affluence, and the rest of us have been left to cope in a way. Is that in part what this is nostalgic for? On the one hand, a very shared sense of sacrifice, but also it takes place in the East End, mm-hmm. right? A working class that is still rooted in the nuclear family, that's still tribal, and looks out for its own. Is that what we're getting from this show?
I definitely think, again, in Britain, I think there's a huge resonance of around austerity. I mean, there's been a whole lot of exploration of that era of late, partly because right now Britain is pursuing austerity policies, or the Conservative government is pursuing austerity policies, but it is a very different country. Call the Midwife is at heart about middle and, in one case, a very upper-class woman kind of going and living among these people who are not like them by birth, but with whom they find commonality and, as you say, make shared sacrifices. They don't live in luxury. They live in a convent that's falling down. They eat the same kinds of food as the people they're helping. Yeah, this was a time when everybody had to, you know, use their ration books and go and get that however many ounces of sugar that they were allotted for the week. So, yeah, I definitely think that's a huge part of it. There are a lot of sort of dog whistle messages being made in this show that I think Britons will take, you know, will interpret in one way, and that Americans, I think, will probably take in a little differently. And I think that it's the good thing about this show is that it does work on both levels, that you don't have to, you know, be catching all these, you know, muffled references. It's also a really good story, and it has some great characters. And, you know, it's all around a win-win experience.
All right. Well, moving on. Britney Spears is, of course, the giant pop icon whose heyday was probably more like about 8 or 10 years ago. She's now following in the footsteps of Sinatra, Celine Dion, Elton, Elvis, everybody. And she's going to Vegas. She signed on to perform 50 shows each in 2014 and 2015 at something called the Axis Theater. And we're taking this as an occasion to think about her. It's a better occasion than her 8th studio album, which has just come out, and which Jody Rosen, the ex-music critic for Slate, used as an occasion to call her the most boring person on the planet. Dana, I don't think anything one saw in this E! Documentary, which accompanies her move to Vegas, it's called I Am Britney Jean, goes any step towards countering the idea that there's something, well, if not completely empty, at least sort of sad about this person and where she's ended up. What do you make of Britney Spears? Is it someone you think about at all, the arc of this poor young woman who went from being a kind of pop goddess to being kind of somewhat sad and used up? What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, Britney Spears has such a weird arc, right? Because she was kind of always used up. I feel like her narrative has always been that she was the exploited little girl whose life was ruined by various, you know, men, by Kevin Federline, the guy who was her much tabloid chronicled husband in the, I guess, early aughts, and her parents who have swooped down in various ways and tried to take her money. And I don't know, she's always seemed to me like that sort of poor little match girl victim figure. So it's very different for example, Celine Dion's Vegas show, which is this I don't know, triumphal reign of a queen who built her own theater. And, you know, I mean, Celine Dion, for all, you know, we may find her music unbearable, but she is kind of a phenomenon, a vocal phenomenon and kind of a pop phenomenon. Britney Spears has always seemed to me like this complete nothing that this fame is being projected onto from different sources.
Right. I completely agree with that. And that, to me, June, that just raises the next question, which is why was it that this was the appropriate screen upon which people projected an enormous amount of longing, desire, interest, intrigue for the period that they did? I mean, how can you, just by way of obvious comparison, you know, probably ridiculously obvious comparison, I mean, I didn't especially like Madonna, but I understood that there was an inner furnace to the woman that would keep her interesting for as long as she was alive. And it was just as clear to me looking at Britney Spears for the first time that she lacked it. What I never understood is why in the first place.
I think that Madonna and Britney are polar opposites. As you say, Madonna seems to be driven by this inner fire. She is an entrepreneurial kind of figure. She makes things happen. You know, she makes the weather. It feels like Britney is a blank screen on which things are projected. And I just want to defend her a little bit. I am by no means a Britney completist. But, you know, to me, Britney Spears is one of those artists who, you know, if you ask me now to sing some of her hits, I would, you know, squeak out a couple of choruses. But I'm no expert. But when I'm in a place where there's sort of, you know, not club dancing, but, you know, just some basic dancing, when Britney's songs come on, they are, you know, great, great pop songs. They've got great hooks. She's not a particularly good singer. She's not a particularly good dancer, but she has somehow been put in the middle of some really fantastic pop songs for the last 10, 15 years. So she's a very different kind of talent, but it is a talent, and I think it's perfect for Las Vegas. The whole arc of this E! Documentary was about, we've only got 4 months, how are we going to put on a show? And, you know, your first thought is, dude, you got 4 months, why are you panicking? I think that's pretty much enough time, do you think, to maybe get 24 songs together?
Also, couldn't they have just started earlier?
Exactly. I mean, you
also
know,
it's probably more like 8 to 12 songs.
They say there's 23 songs in the show.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, that's a lot of songs.
Yeah, it's a lot of songs. And I mean, it's, you know,
incredible. Well, she seems hardworking. You have to say that for her.
And it just sort of felt like it was all very, you know, a lot of fake drama, a lot of, will we have this? Will this be ready? Like, yeah, it's going to be ready. I think we can pretty much, mm-hmm. you know that. But it looked like a great show. I mean, and it seems like it's a really smart thing for Vegas to offer up a different kind of person show, you know, a different kind of musical niche, somebody who's very popular with the gays. I mean, it just feels like it makes perfect sense for Las Vegas. And having watched that documentary, I kind of want to see the show.
I'm sorry, but I could not make it through I Am Britney Jean. It made me too sad to see the interview clips with her because, well, she actually seems like a fairly happy person now, but she seems like someone whose whole brain and whose every sort of nerve synapse has been so formed by her last 15 years of being famous and followed by paparazzi that she almost has no subjectivity at all, and that just made it really hard to watch.
I mean, it was so striking. And there's not only in the sort of the interview scenes with her, which were just so bland. I mean, the first thing that they show, which is so bizarre to me, is they're asking her, you know, what's your favorite kind of bubble gum, and she's water, you know, like as if that's the kind of nonsense that she's, you know, met with every day.
That seemed almost cruel to her.
It
you know,
did.
That, she probably thought that was a mic check.
Yeah,
you know, what's your favorite kind of bubble gum?
Absolutely.
Watermelon. And it turns out to be the keystone first moment
of
her interview.
But the thing that was really striking to me were the scenes that were her personal life. So there's the one section that really was very hard for me not to hit fast forward was there's a scene where it's Thanksgiving and she's with her family and, you know, just a very dull person who really doesn't have anything. She doesn't say anything interesting. She doesn't, you know, it really is clear. And, you know, all these people who interview keep saying, you know, I didn't realize, Britney, that you're shy. And you think, well, you said shy, but you meant boring. She doesn't have anything to say, but maybe that's perfect.
But maybe she'd like to have a Thanksgiving dinner without, you know, 12 paparazzi making an E! Documentary Channel movie about
her.
Right, but the sad thing about that, Dan, is that you don't get the sense that there's some wonderful, gemütlich, happy Thanksgiving to be had without the paparazzi. I mean, that's what's painfully sad is that you sense that aside from the social horizon of paparazzi and fame of living inside a television set, there's nothing that precedes it or nothing interior to her that would ballast it or counteract it. And that has risen up into her eyes. That to me is just the, you know, achingly sad part of that documentary is that kind of slightly confused and I think very lonely and pained look in her eyes. I mean, I hate to project upon it, but I want to add very quickly that I agree with you, June, 100%, that there's something, such as it is, redemptive about the Vegas show being a success and her perhaps having found her thing going forward, right? It would really make sense for her to do this for the next 30 years. You could see it becoming a fixture. She'd make a ton of money. She'd have an act. And, you know, instead of it kind of crashing and burning or becoming, you know, truly sad, you know, it's something for her to do that seems appropriate to her talents. I still say it raises the question of why was a cipher the exact right person at the right time? I mean, even Jody in his review, Jody loves pop music and he loves the idea of pop music no longer being about the quote unquote auteur, about the author, that the author is really this collaborative effort of producers and songwriters on a factory model, you know, cranking out hits, to which the pop star is incidental. And I almost think that she's evidence of the apex of that moment where it was almost like trying to prove how much of a pop icon you could make out of a nothing, out of a person who really lacked even some fundamental charisma. And that was sort of as far as it could go, but that she can be, you know, she herself, the actual person who at the end of the day is at the heart of that whole enterprise, you know, might find a sense of purpose and God knows endless amounts of bank in Vegas. That strikes me as kind of heartwarming in a bizarre way.
Well, and I really think that we owe this to Britney. We've put her through this. We've stalked her. We've set photographers outside her home. We made her shave her head, for goodness sake. And to me, that whole time of when she had to shave her head because she was afraid, I think, allegedly, of a drug test, it just proves that she's a person who needs to be working.
I think that you guys have nailed what it is about Britney that people want to go and see. I think that actually that rescue fantasy is a part of Britney fandom, and that never really occurred to me before. But if you are going to see her Vegas show, kind of supporting her comeback in some way, and she's had so many comebacks, essentially her career is one long series of comebacks, then you are one of the saviors. You're not one of the bad people who's abusing Britney. And it seems like that must be part of the whole experience.
Leave Britney alone.
Ooh, I like it. What a great theory, and what a great way to kick off 2014, right? With a kind of, you know, little waft of hope for all of us, including multi-billion-dollar pop stars. Fantastic. You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gapfest, where you can also leave a comment. And you'll find longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, SoundCloud, or in the WNYC iPhone app. Just search for Slate Gapfest. Gapfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Ann Hepperman and Mike Volo. Our interns are Rebecca Cohen and Anna Schechtman. And the executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the Gapfest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf, and we'll talk to you next week. So